The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.
Okay, it's time to talk football to start The Last Word in Sport. Mark Lawrenson and Miguel Delaney, chief football writer at The Independent, are with us. Mark, let's start with the Manchester derby tomorrow evening. Manchester City returned to a bit of good form the other night. Manchester United had a big victory when they beat Tottenham under Mourinho at Old Trafford. Mm. But it's a difficulty for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is that almost every time he gets a big step up, he gets slapped down again. Would you fear for him when they go to play against City?
Yeah, I would, Matt. For two reasons. It would appear that it's very easy for Manchester United's players to raise the games against top teams, and it's the kind of the mundane, for want of a better description, the mundane games where they seem to have a real problem getting themselves ready and obviously, you know, up for it. The thing about United going to Manchester City is that, like most teams who go there, not without the ball for long, long periods. And I just don't see Manchester United getting a result, Matt, there, because I just think with City, they've had a little bit of a wobble. I thought they were very, very good at Burnley. We know that's a difficult place to go. Otamendi came in and did extremely well. And I wouldn't mind betting you, Matt, that Manchester City kick on a little bit, and that would include for me tomorrow night. By the way, the other thing is, why have Manchester Police let them play at 5 o'clock at night? I've never heard of that before.
A 5:30 kickoff because it's television, Mark.
Oh, sorry, Matt. Yeah, where have I been for the last 49 years?
Miguel Delaney, though, how do Manchester United approach a game like this? Because certainly against Tottenham, they got on the front foot and they took the game to Tottenham. Can they really afford to do that against a Manchester City team and not risk being picked off? Or indeed, will they be able to get on the front foot given the way Manchester City dominate possession in most cases?
Yeah, I think it's going to be a game that really, it suits how Solskjaer best like to set up. But that, of course, raises bigger questions about what he's actually trying to do at United, because they're essentially, they play small team football, usually. Which is why I think they have struggled against lesser teams, and some of it, and most of his better results have actually come in the bigger games. He's actually got quite a decent record, and I think it's because he's essentially content to let his team sit and try and use their fast players to break, which will suit a match against City. But I agree with Mark. I don't think City are going to be as susceptible to this as Spurs were, as other sides like Arsenal and even Liverpool to a degree have been, because I think they'll just pick United off tomorrow. If you go back to the game they played in April at Old Trafford, City were just patient in that game, and they kind of knew that eventually the break would come, and I expect something similar tomorrow.
Do you think have City perhaps turned a corner with their performance the other night, 4 goals?
I thought they were excellent. One of the best performances I've seen them in some time. And they looked kind of slick again, like that kind of fully functioning machine, whereas they've been a little bit, you know, rusty over the previous 2 months. Things weren't coming off. They certainly, the defence and kind of midfield looked so easy to get at. And I think part of that might be a player like Rodri, who's kind of just got more and more used to what Guardiola wants to do. And of course, scored that brilliant goal as well.
Let's move on. Everton against Chelsea is the lunchtime game tomorrow. A lot of attention on that because Everton have finally got rid of Marco Silva. But would you have sympathy for him, Mark, in the sense that that last minute VAR decision on the goal that led Leicester won last week, and then sort of a bizarre game against Liverpool when Liverpool get 5 shots on target. Do you feel that he's been a little bit unlucky, or has he only himself to blame for his transfer purchases and his team selections?
Well, we're assuming he made the transfer purchases, Matt. I'm not sure. But, you know, the fact that they didn't sign an out-and-out centre-forward, I think, was a massive mistake. That's the first thing, because we know that strikers score goals, win you games. I wouldn't have much sympathy for him. I thought that, certainly at Leicester, they played well in the main part. But once Leicester went to 2 up front, the 3 at the back from Manchester City just seemed to disappear. The other night, Matt, I lost count of the number of kind of straight balls over or through the 3 centre-backs. It was embarrassing. It really seriously was. And no wonder Liverpool, you know, didn't have too many shots. They didn't need to, because every time they got through in those positions, they scored, and they scored easily. But, you know, it's an embarrassment for the owner, for me, this thing with Marco Silva. They took him from Watford. We know all about what happened, etc. He's not really had a particularly good record in any of the teams that he's managed in England.
He did well with Hull when he joined them in the first case, kept them up, didn't he?
He kept them up, but Matt, you know, keeping a team up, scratching enough points to keep a team in the league, yes, it's an achievement. But, you know, this was Everton spending millions and hundreds of millions to improve the side, you know, to be in the top six, or at least to be around the top six. They've been nowhere near the top six. And this is my other point, Matt, and I think it's probably the most pertinent one. Has he made any player at Everton better than when he took over? And I have to tell you, absolutely not.
Indeed, he made some strange selections. I mean, what's the word on Seamus Coleman? Has he been dropped out of the squad, or has he injury problems? Because he's not been in the team in recent weeks.
I'm guessing a little bit that maybe the manager thinks that his legs have gone a little bit. But, you know, Sidibe played there on Sunday against Leicester and played well, and then he got hauled off in the first half against Liverpool on Wednesday. So, I mean, you know, I would imagine Seamus is sat there thinking, this is absolutely madness. But I can only imagine, Matt, that they maybe think that his legs have gone.
Okay, Miguel, do you have any information on that? Because I would suspect this has all the appearances. New manager goes into Everton, and one of the first names he puts back on the team sheet for the experience he'll bring is Seamus Coleman's.
Yeah, he's kind of one of the few leaders in that squad. I think there was suspicion that Mark's right in terms of Coleman. Maybe his legs are gone, but also kind of points to Silva's indecisiveness a bit in that way. I suppose he never kind of had a sense of his best team. But I think I would have sympathy for the Silva in the sense that I think Everton's one of the most difficult jobs to manage at the moment for all sorts of reasons. But basically, they're an example of a club. And this happened to a fair few clubs in Europe, a fair few kind of historically big clubs that are now struggling in this kind of super club era where you have kind of a group of 10 to 12 who are on a completely different financial footing to everyone else, City, Liverpool, United, Real Madrid, Barcelona. And a club like Everton, basically, they have this pressure from their own history and their own success. And it creates an impatience that kind of manifests itself in what they don't really know what they want to be or what their place is.
Okay, is it going to be David Moyes taking over? Mark, he's your mate. Is that a fair question to ask you?
Of course it's a fair question. I think he'd love to go, Matt. It's just a case of in what capacity. You know, are they going to say to him, we think we might, you know, we need to avoid relegation. We want you to keep us up. And then if you keep us up, does he get another contract if it's only to the end of the season? So it's a really, really difficult one. I think, Matt, if it was down to Bill Kenwright, I think David Moyes would already be managing and he will be in charge against Chelsea tomorrow. I just think Bill doesn't quite have the power that he did have under Mashiri. And I think ultimately, Mashiri has the final say. I'm not quite sure whether he thinks the appointment of Moyes would be a backward step. But at the moment, Matt, it may not be, may it?
OK, Chelsea, of course, got news today, Miguel, that they don't have the transfer ban on anymore. So does that give them a really good shot now after the work that Frank Lampard has done to date with the young players, that now he can bring in a few extra ones and secure a Champions League spot for next year?
Certainly need a defender, because that defence does look easy to get at. But I think there's an interesting thing there, because I was talking to someone at Chelsea this week and they were saying that one of the keys to this season and why it's clicked so quickly is basically because this is a young group of players, very, very invested in the group. There's a real kind of cohesion and spirit to them, to that group, that has brought something to Chelsea that they haven't really experienced in some time. Maybe not since kind of Mourinho was first there between 04 and 07, but in a different way because there's so many homegrown players. And I do wonder in situations like this whether that can maybe just disrupt it slightly, because now, having kind of carved out this identity for themselves at the start of the season, whether it's going to slightly change a little bit in January. Although in saying that, I do actually think they need a defence. I think it's one of the flaws in Lampard's approach so far.
Okay, also Liverpool, of course, continue their march towards the title away at Bournemouth tomorrow. Of course, Eddie Howe has been mentioned as another possibility for Everton, Mark.
Yes, but last time he came up to the North West, he didn't last too long. Mind you, he was at Burnley, Matt, which is understandable. But do they need Eddie? The thing is, Matt, we don't really know what the owner wants. Yes, he wants to be successful, but how's he going to do that? Who's buying the players at Everton? You know, who's not obviously gone, hold on a minute, before we sign all these other players, get the top end of the pitch right, get ourselves a goal scorer so that, you know, if you can sort out the defensive area, which is easier than obviously the forward area, you've got a guy who's going to pinch your goals and win your games and get your points. So I don't really know what Mashiri wants. And I tell you what, if they go for another foreign manager, I think it would be very, very interesting to see the home crowd, not so much the away crowd at Everton, in how they react to that. I have a feeling, and I'm guessing a little bit, that they're almost like, you know what, get us somebody who knows all about our club, and at the very least, get some pride back into Goodison.
And would you expect Liverpool to win at Bournemouth tomorrow?
I expect them to win every week, Matt, as you know.
What about Spurs, Miguel? Because that was a bit of a fall to earth for Mourinho, going back to Old Trafford on Wednesday night and certainly seeing that his former players were more up for the game than his current players.
Yeah, that was it. Look, particularly players like Fred and Rashford, given his, I think, rather pointed social media post, given some of what Mourinho said about him when he was a Sky pundit, silencing the doubters. But I'd actually be slightly worried for Spurs after that performance, because I thought it looked like Mourinho's United at their worst. And that was after he was there kind of like two years, really, in that it was, despite being a manager who kind of, I suppose, built his career on building defences, this was, again, easy to get at, something that's been a feature more of his later sides. And also, they were kind of just so uninspired in how they actually played. There didn't seem to be much attacking structure there. And they're kind of reliant on individual flashes, which is how they got the goal and how United were under them for so long.
Leicester are away at Villa on Sunday. Mark, I'm going to go back to you in this, because Brendan Rodgers has done another magnificent job in getting himself an extra 5.5-year contract on the back of speculation that he might be a target for Arsenal as new manager. That said, the way they're playing at Leicester at the moment, he does seem to deserve it, doesn't he?
Yeah, Matt, he's been very clever so far, so very, very good. Got the big sort of, you know, the big personalities like the Schmeichels, the Morgans and the Vardys all together as soon as he went in. Got them sorted. They very much, if you're looking at a dressing room with power, if you've got those three pulling for you as a manager, you've got a real chance. They're a good side, Matt. They're a very, very good side. Good luck to him. I don't think for a moment that he would have become Arsenal's new manager. I really don't, because he'd have looked at Arsenal and looked at his own team and thought, we are better. And the other thing, if I just very quickly will say that, I mean, you know, we talk about bringing players into teams and bringing players into clubs. So Arsenal spent $72 million on the left winger from Lyon, Pepe, right? Matt, a blind man on a galloping horse knows that the problem is defensively. So who's in charge of recruitment there? No wonder they're slipping down the league.
Well, indeed, Miguel, another defeat under Freddie Ljungberg now as temporary manager last night at home to Brighton. Who'd want that Arsenal job? I suppose it pays a big enough salary and there's a big enough transfer budget likely to be there. But that looks like a hell of a difficult job.
Yeah, I mean, some what we said about Everton a few minutes ago applies in almost a bigger sense to Arsenal. And there's suddenly that slight danger with them. They're losing their status as one of those big clubs, given that they spent so long out of the Champions League. They're losing some of their pull, and it feels like there's just not much direction at the top of the club. I mean, even before Emery was sacked, and you're kind of talking to people looking when it was actually going to happen, a lot of people coming back saying stuff like, it's hard to know who makes the decisions around here. And I think that kind of has manifested itself on the pitch. They really just look a basket case at the moment. And I mean, one of the things, I mean, Allegri's name is mentioned as regards that job, but I've heard that he has little interest because he thinks the structure is so bad. They've got a lot to fix there. And it looks pretty bleak, to be honest, for a while.
Okay, one final thing, Mark, I want to throw at you. Last night, Sheffield United lost at home to Newcastle. They're giving out about VAR because of the second goal that was given.
Yeah.
It was a long ball went forward. The linesman put his flag up and the Sheffield United defender stopped playing and Newcastle got the goal.
Yeah.
Now, you'd be sympathetic to them, except then I realised when I was reading about this, because I didn't see the game, the referee didn't blow his whistle.
He didn't.
So surely, just because our flag goes up, surely you wait until the referee blows his whistle.
Yeah, absolutely, totally. Always be a pessimist, Matt, as I keep telling you, as a defender. Always, always be a pessimist. The goalkeeper hardly even tried to stop Shelby's goal as well. And you know, you should know the way VAR is. You've just got to keep playing. And if the referee doesn't blow his whistle, well, you play on, don't you?
Mark Lawrence and Miguel Delaney of The Independent, thank you very much for joining us. OK, let's look forward to weekend's rugby action, the Champions Cup. Munster are at home to Saracens. Earlier this year, the semi-finalists in Coventry, Saracens overcame a brave Munster attempt, but yet again, much too good for Munster. But the Saracens team coming to Thomond Park tomorrow evening is an understrength one. So Neil Francis, having perhaps devalued the English club competition by the way that they have spent their way to success, are they now devaluing European competition by sending a deliberately understrength team to Thomond Park tomorrow night?
They have their reasons, so I think they'll save themselves, you know, because the you know, if they ever went down to the Green King Championship, it'd be a disaster. Disaster for them, disaster for England, but I must say I'm not sorry for them. And you're right, it does hugely devalue. So they've already been fined, and they could be fined again, I think, just under the rules, because there's nothing wrong with the Bunapolis, there's nothing wrong with you know, Owen Farrell. So they're not picking their strongest side, and they can be fined for that. I don't think it bothers them that much, because they still have, I don't know, it's about 28 points to make up on Leicester. So yeah, it does value, but I don't think Munster would be too unhappy about it. So I think tomorrow's game will be not really what we were looking for. I mean, there's big attendance, there's extra seatage been put in, but unfortunately the match that will count will be the one in Allianz Park next week, and we get a fair idea of how good Munster are. That's not to say, actually, that Saracens won't be very competitive.
It's still not a bad-looking team. They've still got Itoje in the second row alongside Skelton, the Australian. There's lots of good, big-name players in there.
Yeah, I don't know. It was an interesting team that was named by Van Graham. So he's picked Tyke Byrne, you know, at six. So that 4-5-6-7-8 of Saracens is just enormous. Like Nick Ezekwe is 6'7". He's just enormous. Will Skelton is huge. So I think maybe with a nod to that, Munster have picked as big a side and as good a side as they could have, certainly in that area in 4-5. So they, you know, they'll have their hands full. And I don't think, you know, I was quite surprised. I mean, I said it after the game there. I was quite surprised how good Racing were the week before last, how up for it they were. And, you know, you never know. We always say that. You never know with the French. You know that Saracens are going to travel, and you know that they have a pretty good idea that they're going to be as close to beating Munster. So what I'm saying to you is, you know, next week we have an idea about how good Munster will be.
Don't mind about next week. Paul Wallace, what about tomorrow night? Because could this Saracens team be good enough to beat Munster? And what do you make of Munster not only putting Tyburn at six and Peter O'Mahony at seven? No room in the squad for Tommy O'Donnell either, and they have three second row back rows in the substitutes, Finian Witcherly, Jack O'Donoghue and Arno Botha, just going with two covering the backs.
Yeah, well, they're looking at a pretty straightforward up front battle with Saracens. Saracens had overpowered them last year. With the selection that's there, and of course when the Munster team has been selected, I'm sure they didn't know what side Saracens were going to come over with. Just coming back to what Neil was saying there, I think they will end up ring-fencing the Premiership over there. But in any case, I think people, you know, rugby people in the various clubs over there expect Saracens to be free of relegation the way they're going at the moment by the end of January. So I think they just want to get out as one of the losers in the group, and when they get back and they're free of relegation, which is disastrous to any club for that to happen, and you can see why they would be prioritising that. It'll be a case of, well, with our best team, home or away, we reckon we'll give any team a good go, and I don't think anyone would want to see them after winning a home quarter final. So I think that's what they're looking at. There was some very good talent in that side, yeah, lots of pace. I guess Munster would have guessed from what Saracen selections had been that they weren't going to go with all the big England players that we all know very well. Of course, they got Itoje in there, some big players like Lamas Sotelli and Skelton. So they're a big pack, but you just think the experience that's there, do they have what it takes to go to Thomond Park and win? win. I think there's the fearlessness of youth, the likes of Seguin on the wing, really quick, Lazowski very creative, but I think to come somewhere, a fortress like Thomond Park, it's a well-settled Munster side, as you say, Tyburn in the back row, they're really going to target the line-out, I would imagine, and really try and overpower Saracens up front, and then once they get that, then they have that you know, bringing the likes of the form finishers like Earls, Conway, and you know Haley, who's really adding from the back as well. So I think it'll be direct first from Munster and opening up later.
Okay, Leinster go to Northampton, lunchtime game tomorrow. Neil Francis, Leinster are in fantastic form so far this year. Would you expect them to continue that in this away encounter at Franklin's Gardens?
Yeah, I thought. I watched the Glasgow game last week, and I just thought they were superb in that. Now, Glasgow have just lost it, and I think the touch of the Joe Schmitz about, you know, announcing your retirement early. Dave Rennie decided to go, and I think he's lost it. So Glasgow aren't the team they used to be, and they're waiting for a new coach to come in. Having said that, you know, Leinster packed out a kind of a junior side against them, and did very well. Now they're bringing back all their key guys. The key one there is Gibson Park. Now I think it's going to be a pretty loose game. Northampton, I've only seen them once this year, and they really are very good at throwing the ball around. So it could be a Leinster probably just sort of saying, okay, we'll come play fancy stuff with you. Now Gibson Park, couple of elements to it. I just thought Luke McGrath had a very, very poor game against Lyon, and it's unlike him, and he made, I don't know, six or seven really bad mistakes there, and in good situations where you could have won the game. Like, you know, they could have won against Lyon far more convincingly than they did, and there were about three or four aspects of the game there where McGrath just made simple mistakes, and you can't afford that. So the competition in the squad, and that's what happens. So Gibson Park has been playing very well. He gets the start. He'll probably get, I don't know, get 60 minutes. So I think it's going to be a very, very loose game, a very entertaining game. One of the things that I, in the preamble to it, which I just couldn't quite understand, they're sort of saying, oh, Northampton are following Leinster's way in terms of getting an academy going and bringing through and blooding a lot of their, you know, their academy stock, but I can't see it. I'm just looking at the team there. There are a lot of them, two thirds of the team are kind of foreigners from outside, and the rest of the guys have been there a long time. So, but very, you know, there aren't too many well known names in that, but there's some serious performers.
In that game. What's really interesting about Leinster is the way that even for this new season they've refreshed, and Ronan Kelleher now seems to have nailed down the hooking spot. And Caelan Doris, really, he had an injury, an unfortunate injury in the first round of the Champions Cup, but he's back in at number 8. This seems to be one of the keys to Leinster, is that they're able to refresh with a couple of new players from the ranks every year.
Yeah, I mean, you think Sean O'Brien going, and Conan, who looked like the heir apparent at number 8, getting that injury, you know, for the power player in the back row. And then you just need to look at the next one on the conveyor belt, as you said there, Matt. I think that balance, albeit Max Deegan has played very well in every step he goes up, especially in open play, I think he's a class operator. But I think the work rate, the power of Caelan Doris, it just fits in well with Van de Fleer, who isn't the biggest number 7 on the stage, but, you know, incredibly effective and played really well again the last round. But with Reece Ruddock, the three of them there, I think there's good balance between ball carrying, you know, the physicality of Ruddock and Van de Fleer's ability around the park and breakdown. So it looks like it's, you know, a very well-balanced back row when you look at the line-out presence that they have with Ryan and Toner, and you don't really need an out-and-out back row jumper like an Omani when you've got Devon Toner in your side. You can just go to him all day. Saying that, there is a line-out ability there. So it looks a good side. And Gibson Parr coming in, he's more experienced than McGrath. He's a very talented player. Again, it's on the road, so it'll be difficult for him. And a lot to be asked of Dave Carney. I think it's great to see him get the opportunity. There's a lot of injury problems Robbins, who's a very, very error-free player. He's a very smart player. He's got a big defensive job up against Naya Ravoro, who's a great attacking player if he gets lots of ball, and I think that might be one of the reasons why they have him on the wing as well. I think Leinster need to jump up again. They've been great at grafting out wins, but I think there's another gear they can actually get up to.
What about Connacht? How difficult is it going to be at King's Home against Gloucester? But again, quite a few changes to the Connacht side. I'm not sure whether it's down to injury or just juggling resources.
Yeah, I think psychologically going to Gloucester has not been a good place for Connacht. They've had some great success in France in particular over the years in Europe, but going to England has been difficult. I don't think it's a great Gloucester side. They've got some great flair players in Cipriani and Gibson, Simpson in the halfbacks. You know, they're big, powerful back row. And pack for that matter, and I think that's where Connacht need to play. We all know about their ability out wide, and they've looked very sharp in all season again this year, but it's up front, it's the front five. I think if they need the platform, if they can go there and get that platform and play with the same intensity, you know, Gloucester are no Toulouse. If they can go there and play with that ability with a bit more finishing and stay in the game a bit longer, I think they've really got a good shot at it.
And Neil Francis, just to finish, Ulster have had a very good start to their pool, and another opportunity now with Harlequins at home. Would you expect them to win that tomorrow?
Yeah, I think their leader, and he's become their spiritual leader. I just think Cooney is so good right now, and if he backs what he did against Claremont up tomorrow, you'll see him in the Ireland squad. I think Ulster just have a little bit between the teeth here. I think Harlequins really, they're not a Champions Cup side. I think Ulster will win that one handy.
Thank you very much, Paul Wallace and Neil Francis, for joining us here on The Last Word at Today FM. Paul Early, explain to me, please, the possible changes to the Football Championship in 2021 according to this new report of the Fixtures Calendar Review Task Force.
Good evening, Matt. Well, reading through the report, is a 68-page report, and it's quite comprehensive. And to be fair to the committee, they've done a very decent job in compiling it and trying, I think, to balance, I suppose, or to ensure that, I suppose, if there's a club fixture program, or to develop a club fixture program, a definite club fixture program in line with a definite inter-county fixture program as well. So the main recommendations. And there are 32 recommendations in the actual report. The main two options for the intercounty, I suppose, and the club structure are that option one is that they would move to a situation where they would have eight teams in each province. So you'd play the continue with the provincial championship, but move to a starting position where there would be eight teams in each. That would mean that three teams from Leinster would move to Munster or Connacht, and maybe and one team from Ulster. So your starting position would be eight teams in each province, and they would have two groups of four in each with a round-robin system with three minimum of three games for each team.
Okay.
Eight positions.
What do you make of that? Because, and I have Dick Clerken on the line as well, because there is a second option. But on that option one, do you think that, for example, would you have a name drawn out of the hat each year to move out of Ulster, or would you have a county moving permanently out of Ulster? Would, like, for example, actually, I'll bring you in the stick. You know, would you like to see perhaps Monaghan moved to Connacht?
Well, I suppose of all the options, good evening, Matt and Paul, that's probably going to be probably the most difficult one, because GAA is built in tradition and parish boundaries, provincial boundaries are almost sacrosanct in a lot of people's heads. So the notion that a Monaghan or a Cavan or a Donegal might drop to Connacht or go to Leinster is very hard in the short term for anyone to fathom. So, you know, it's in terms of the structure, obviously it makes sense. You have 32 counties and it's nice and clean. But that would be a very difficult one for an awful lot of counties,
Paul,
especially the counties that might be applied to think that they mightn't have that tradition behind them again.
Paul, would you suspect for that very reason this is a non-runner?
I don't think it's necessarily a non-runner. I think there's an appetite for change, and that's kind of come through very clearly from the report and from the survey. I think they did an online survey, about 1,300 people responded to that, and there were a number of submissions, and it's clear from that there is an appetite for change, and perhaps this is radical change as well. The positives to that structure are that there's a minimum of four games for every county in the championship, which is a plus. Also, when you look at the detail within the report, what they're suggesting is that if they go down this route, that increases the number of available club weekends from 12 to 15. So obviously that allows club fixtures to be planned in advance and to improve obviously the number of available available times for the clubs. So I do accept that it's challenging, and I think the determination of which teams from Ulster or Leinster would be moved to the other provinces would be based on league position.
Okay. Can we move on? So in the time we've available to us, Paul, sorry, can you explain the second option, which is one that the GAA president John Horan suggests he's in favour of?
This is quite a radical one. This is where they move the league to the summer months as the basis for the championship. So there's a strong link then between the league and the championship. They continue to play the provincial championships, but they're of lesser importance. They play them in February, March. Again, 54% of people in the survey supported retaining the provincial championships. 46% were not in favour. And then you play, so the leagues are in summer, and then the top four teams in Division 1, the top two teams in Division 2, the top team in Division 3, and the top team in Division 4 all qualify for the quarterfinals. So that would be quite radical, and that maybe teams 5 and 6 in the Division 1 would not have an opportunity to play in the quarterfinals. So the league positions obviously then determine the route for the counties to qualify for the All-Ireland Senior Championships. There would also then be the other teams would play off in the Tier 2 competition.
Okay, Dick Clerkin, what's your assessment of that proposal?
Well, the first thing, as Paul opened there, like I was probably like a lot of people, Matt, with all the preamble over the last couple of weeks, expecting a fairly sanitised document coming out of Croke Park. Nobody expected anything like this. So when I seen 68 pages, I said, all right, it's probably a lot of verbiage. But when you look at the likes of this coming up as a formal proposal that's going to be voted on, like this isn't a white paper, like everyone, I don't know, 10 years ago had their own championship ideas, but these are proposals now going to be voted on. And this one for me, you know, as Paul said, it's dramatic, but you know, you're really taking a competition that works, the National League. We know it's the best competition probably in the GAA at the moment in terms of its competitiveness, its equity, and you're moving it to the time of the year that people want to see inter-county players playing, inter-county players want to be playing. So at a very simple base level, Matt, there's an awful lot to be said for
but
that.
But could you end up killing the provincial championships of Connacht and Ulster by moving? I think actually, in fairness, it's got to the stage where the provincial titles in Munster and Leinster do not mean as much as they once did, because they're so dominated by Kerry and Munster and Dublin and Leinster. But Connacht and Ulster still are really competitive, really fought for. Would you actually devalue them by playing them in February and March?
Potentially you would, and there's no point in saying otherwise. But like, there is no, and we all know this at this stage, there's no simple fix that to make a dramatic change from where we're at, that there isn't going to have to be some sacrificial lamb in terms of either provincial boundaries, the status of the provincial competitions, or whatever. So it's going to come now to the people in the GAA to decide, well, what is the lesser of all these evils? And, you know, as you just said, Matt, and everyone would recognise, a lot of the provincial championships have diminished. Even if the competitive ones, you know, look at Donegal there. Donegal won the last two provincial finals, great, but did take progress in an All-Ireland series, an All-Ireland final, I'd say, much greater over that.
Okay.
So
Paul Early,
I think there's a lot of potential in that one, Matt, out of all of the options.
Would you like that one to be the ultimate decision?
Yeah, I certainly would. I would be in favour of retaining the provincial championships, and maybe my views are coloured by, you know, the fact that my home county, Roscommon, it meant so much the last couple of years, seeing Monaghan, Dix County win a couple of titles, seeing Sligo a few years ago, seeing Wexford obviously winning the Leinster Hurling, how much it meant to them. So I still think there's value. And I also think another part of this is that, you know, the value of the provincials as well as the local rivalries, the playing against the county next year, that the GAA is built on those local rivalries, and it would be a shame to let those go. But I do like the radical proposal as well. I think the link between the league and the championship, as Dick said, would be very important. Everyone, all the players, I think, and everybody views the league as the fairest competition out there. And 7 games over 8 or 9 weeks in February and March. It's the one I think that players look forward to, the big way that fans look forward to as well. And teams are played against teams of equal ability. So I would like to see that. I'm not sure that the GAA is ready for this. I think the committee, and you know, if you read between the lines and read some of the commentary on the report, I think they feel that this might be potentially as a runner, but the timing may not be right for this, and it may potentially be reviewed in the future. I don't think it will happen in 2021. But I do think there needs to be some radical thinking and bravery over the next number of months when they bring these proposals around the country.
Paul Early and Dick Clerken, thank you both very much for being with us here on The Last Word on Today FM.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.